Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is June 21st, 1999, and in the fireside room this morning, Marvin Landsverk will be presenting Dylan Thomas and the Old Testament. This tape is 99-1, and so now let's join Marvin for discussion.
But first, I'd like to start with a public service announcement, and it's regarding bears. I mean, you heard them already saying that there's bears around. Yesterday, we were hiking, and just 100 yards out of the village, my little daughter was making a snowball off the road, and then we turned around and walked down the road, and right from where she had just been, a bear popped out and walked across the road. This is true. It's yesterday. And so the rangers have issued this bear warning. There's a few things you should all know when you're out hiking. And one of which is, especially when you're in the backcountry, you should carry bells with you, you know, and jingle, make some noise. And carry pepper spray, especially for the big ones, the Holden Grizz. And the other thing you should know is you should know your bear scat. So if you see black bear scat, you can recognize it because it's little black lumps with seeds in it. And a grizzly bear scat has bells in it and it smells like pepper spray. Remember that. Actually, there are no grizzly bears around here. But we're from Montana. That's where I heard that joke, so it's true for us.
Yeah, squirrels are fierce. We just had to open someone's pack, unattended pack out here to let the squirrel out, and then put it inside, or they say.
Well, this week, what we'll be doing, I'm going to be talking about leaves from the Tree of Life and focusing on a different poet each day who writes poems that have something to do with the theme of the summer, the Tree of Life. Not all the poems are only about trees, but there's trees involved in them. And today's poet is Dylan Thomas. And just a word about my method that I'll be pursuing this week. What I'm using is what I call parabolic method. We all know what parables are. And Jesus tells parables. Parables are stories in the Bible. But when I say I want to pursue a parabolic method, I'm thinking a little bit more literally about what the word parable means. And I like what it means because it's Greek for to throw beside, to throw one thing next to another. Is what a parable is. You understand when Jesus is telling a parable, it's making a comparison. That's really what it means, to put one thing next to another and see what happens. So the kingdom of God is like, well, what could it be like? It's like a mustard seed. And the throw beside aspect of that gives it, I mean, not a very planned or sort of pre-planned feeling. It's just, I mean, what happens when you throw one thing next to another? And that's really what I'm interested in. So what I'd like to do is throw some of Dylan Thomas's poems next to other texts. And those texts are texts from the Bible. That's why the Bibles are in here. If you don't have one, you might want to grab one. To throw some tree texts from the Bible next to some tree poems of Dylan Thomas. And so by way of, you know, if I can ever get done with my introduction by the end, and by the end of the week, we will have sort of collected some thoughts thinking about tree imagery in the Bible and tree imagery as it's been dealt with by a number of poets. But not just to look at each one of them separately, but to see what happens when you stick one of those texts next to another. And certainly, that's what poets do anyway. They're putting words next to each other to see what happens. And my purpose of selection in picking some of these you'll see isn't just to engage in a source study. So I'm not only picking verses necessarily that Dylan Thomas had in mind, although certainly you can see sometimes he must have. But my purpose really is then just to get us thinking, and that's what I'll be interested in. We'll do some reading of some verses and ask you to think, you know, what happens in your mind when these are thrown next to each other? And what happens in your mind may be a comment on the poem or an interpretation of it. But, I mean, one of the wonderful things about teaching literature, which is what I do, I think, is, I mean, when I read poems, I often think about all kinds of other things. I mean, and sometimes I start to get excited about maybe writing some poem of my own that might not have anything specifically to do with the text that's in front of me, and that's fine. I mean, I'm interested in, you know, what you're thinking about when we engage in this parabolic method. One advertisement, too, for Friday. The different sessions, today's Dylan Thomas, tomorrow is Emily Dickinson, then Wednesday is William Blake, who is the poet that's my area of specialty, and then Robert Frost will be Friday, and Saturday, the last day of the series, is called Holden Poems, and for that to work, we need some. So my advertisement is for you maybe to write one this week. You know, if you're going to be around and come back, I mean, write a tree poem or anything. I mean, you know, we won't be too limiting about that. So if during these sessions even, like, if you get an idea and you start writing or you want to leave to go, you know, that's great as far as I'm concerned. That's one of the great things about literature. This morning, I was sitting in bed thinking about writing tree poems and whether that's intimidating or not. I mean, you could write a profound one, you could write a silly one. This limerick popped into my head. So here's my advertisement for writing poems, and no doubt yours can be better than this. This is about the coffee area outside. There once were some beautiful pines that stood outside where Holden dines, but coffee spills soaked and all the trees croaked. Now they're composting up by the mines. So if you're here in older times, you know, when there used to be those nice trees out there. That's so now it's the ark is there. Anyway.
Change is good, Marvin.
I'd like to start, since I've mentioned parables, just by briefly looking at a parable. So we'll start in the Bible. In Matthew 13, we could start in a number of places, but there's a parable that eventually gets to a tree parable, and since we've got trees on our mind, at least we can start there. So I'm in Matthew 13 at the beginning, and I'm not going to read all this. We'll just get our feet wet here. That same day, Jesus went out of the house and sat beside the sea. Such great crowds gathered around him that he got into a boat and sat there, while the whole crowd stood on the beach. And he told them many things in parables, saying, "Listen, a sower went out to sow. And as he sowed, some seeds fell on the path, and the birds came and ate them up. Other seeds fell on rocky ground where they did not have much soil, and they sprang up quickly." You know the parable. It's a great story. "But when the sun rose, and they were scorched, and since they had no root, they withered away. Other seeds fell among the thorns, and the thorns grew and choked them. Other seeds fell on the good soil and brought forth grain, some 100-fold, some 60, some 30. Let anyone with ears listen." And as this goes on then, and the different versions of this, the disciples say, what's this? What's this mean? And Jesus does a little bit of explanation, says, "Okay, well, I'll tell you what the parable means." But he doesn't let the explanation stand on its own. What he does next is tells them another parable. I mean, if you don't get a parable, you probably won't get the explanation, maybe, although this one seems a little bit obvious. But what you get is a cycle of parables. So a parable itself is throwing a word next to another word and making a comparison, but then parables are thrown, piled one next to another in this whole sequence here, with this emphasis on listen. I mean, this refrain, listen, pay attention. And in Mark, I think, I mean, that what it said is a very interesting phrase is, "Take heed how you hear," which is a great message, I think, for anybody involved in a literary study where you're interested in words. Take heed how you hear, and it goes on, for those who have not, or those who have, they will gain even more, and those who have not, even what they have will be taken away from them. I mean, it's a very interesting comment. I mean, part of that I think I take as an order to us to engage in exactly the type of thing that we do up here at Holden when we're looking at text, is take heed how you hear doesn't mean get it right because there's going to be a test at the end of the period. What it means is what you're contributing to the text as you read matters. And what happens when words are set next to each other is serendipitous, and if you pay attention and use your imagination, you'll get more out of it than if you approach a text with not much of something, then even what you started with will be taken away. And I'll take your books away from you if you want. And then eventually this cycle then comes to the mustard seed parable, which again we're familiar with. So we get a tree parable there. So certainly, I mean, if you start looking for trees in the Bible, they're everywhere. Now, I said this is about Dylan Thomas in the Old Testament, and I'm still here in the New Testament, so for this not to be false advertising, we'll have to shift in a minute. But I do want to say a few words about Dylan Thomas, and a very few about his biography, because I'm more interested in his words than his life, really, today. And then let's take a look at some poems. Dylan Thomas... I mean, I always found this to be true in classes I would take. You get into a class, and the first thing you're told is that you're pronouncing the name of the guy wrong. So that, you know, if you're really in the know, you pronounce it this way, or you use a certain name. I mean, I always thought that was sort of stupid. So, you know, everybody in the world pronounces Henry David Thoreau's name in that fashion. Then you're in a class, you're told it's not Thoreau, it's Thoreau. Okay. Well, for Dylan Thomas, I can play that game. When you're in Wales, you know, you're hanging out in Dylan Thomas areas, I mean, they pronounce the name Dolan, as in with the Y-U-S sound, like the county now that is part of Carmarthen, is Dyfed, D-Y-F-E-D, so Dylan Thomas. So if you want to go home and say, you know, you went to a session on Dylan Thomas, then everybody will look at you like, you stupid. It's not Dylan Thomas. And you say, yes, it is. And I can say the longest place name in the world, which happens to be in Wales also, which is Clonvire Puchtwin Gechgo Gerchwindro Buchlon Desilio Go Go Gok. One other person in this room that I know can say that. Anyway, Dylan Thomas was born in Swansea, which is an area that my wife and I lived in for a year a while ago, and we kind of fell in love with Wales. And he was a newspaper reporter for a while, and was discovered when he entered a poetry contest. I mean, this is a great way, you know, just think, you hear these advertised on NPR, and you know, send your poems in, and who knows. So he was discovered, and as a result, got to publish some of his poems, and his first volume was called 18 Poems in 1944, and was a great sensation, and had a fantastic, if short, career following that. The part of the excitement was, because he was so different, what he was writing was so different from the dominant English poetry at the time, of things like T.S. Eliot and T.S. Eliot's followers, which was, I mean, for broad label's sake, had been under kind of classicism for a while. So when Dylan Thomas's wild and violent and powerful imagery came forth, people said, ah, must be new romanticism. We're done with classicism for a while. And as it turned out, I mean, he doesn't really fit the label as a romantic very perfectly, whatever that means, but it was different, certainly, from some of the more subdued aspects of T.S. Eliot's play with language. But what became clear, though, that Dylan Thomas was a master craftsman, not just someone who threw words out to see what happens. I mean, when he's throwing words next to each other, there's this feeling of throwing, but it is planned. But his poetry is incantatory, and it's obscure, and it does commit acts of violence on the language that's fascinating. A couple of his key themes, I just list a few of these and we can see them in action, that's what I want to move to. The unity of life really was his big theme. And he approached it in a religious, mythic fashion. So many of his poems will deal with religious issues. And living in Wales, he's living in a Protestant country and growing up hearing this great tradition of Welsh preaching and oration, which becomes part of what he's wrestling with in his poetry. And you can think of one of the things that he's doing, which is what many poets try to do, but he's taking familiar words, familiar Christian concepts even, and he's putting pressure on them and cracking those words open to make them seem new again. But dealing with many themes that we would identify certainly as Christian. I mean, the unity of life, the processes of life and death, and exploring the mythic understandings that religions explore, that life and death and rebirth are somehow all connected if we can only think about that in the right way. Also then the past and the present he's bringing together. He brings in some Welsh folk tales and runs that into the mix. But the word mythic always comes to mind when I'm thinking about his poetry. He was a great talker. He came to this country for a tour in 1950, again in 1953, and that's when he died, when he was over here in 53. And he was really a huge celebrity, both for his poetry and his presence, and the way he read his own poetry was like a happening. And he was also a big character and a drunk, so that, I mean, when he came over in 53, he didn't like being away from Wales very much, he drunk himself to death. At age of 39, so his bohemian lifestyle finally was the end of him. So I've just mentioned the word parable to start us, and the first thing that I'd like to throw beside then that biblical notion of parable is a birthday poem. And I've got most of these on overheads so that the language just doesn't have to blow by you. I'll put them up there. I don't know. I hope you can see it somewhat. And I'll just read this. This is one of the longer ones. I picked mostly short poems. Part of this game I'm playing could be reduced to what's the connection between the scripture verse that Marvin just picked and the poem. And there's also another game you can play is Find the Tree. So you can be playing that game as I'm reading. Find the Tree reference. But one thing that I want to think about then is, you know, what's happening with trees? How much do they contribute to what's going on in this poem? But I'll tell you in advance the reason I'm starting this poem, because this poem has the word parable in it. So there we go. And it runs on to one more page, which I'd like to find. This is Poem in October. I guess I can read it from there. It was my 30th year to heaven, woke to my hearing from harbor and neighbor wood, and the mussel pooled in the heron priested shore, the morning beckon, with water praying and a call of seagull and rook, and the knock of sailing boats on the net-webbed wall, myself to set foot that second in the still-sleeping town and set forth. My birthday began with the water birds and the birds of the winged trees flying my name above the farms and the white horses. And I rose in rainy autumn and walked abroad in a shower of all my days. High tide and the heron dived when I took the road over the border, and the gates of the town closed as the town awoke. A springful of larks in a rolling cloud, and the roadside bushes brimming with whistling blackbirds, in the sun of October, summery on the hill's shoulder. Here were fond climates, and sweet singers suddenly come in the morning where I wandered and listened to the rain ringing, wind blow cold in the wood far away under me. Pale rain over the dwindling harbor and over the sea-wet church the size of a snail with its horns through mist and the castle brown as owls. But all the gardens of spring and summer were blooming in the tall tales beyond the border and under the lark full cloud. There could I marvel, my birthday away, but the weather turned around. It turned away from the blithe country and down the other air, and the blue altered sky streamed again a wonder of summer with apples, pears, and red currants. And I saw in the turning so clearly a child's forgotten mornings when he walked with his mother through the parables of sunlight and the legends of the green chapels. And the twice told fields of infancy, that his tears burned my cheeks and his heart moved in mine. These were the woods, the river and sea, where a boy, in the listening summertime of the dead, whispered the truth of his joy to the trees and the stones and the fish in the tide, and the mystery sang alive, still in the water and singing birds. And there could I marvel my birthday away, but the weather turned around. And the true joy of the long dead child sang burning in the sun. It was my 30th year to heaven, stood there then in the summer noon, though the town below lay leaved with October blood. Oh, may my heart's truth still be sung on this high hill in a year's turning. That's a bit long to absorb, sort of just like, but you know, there's different ways to sort of feel poetry. So what I'm interested in, I guess, is, I mean, did you see any trees? So it passes a test. Well, it's got a tree in it, so it's okay. What are the trees doing in that poem when they came up? What's the image seem to serve as? I mean, one way even to think about that in a mythic poet's representation is, I mean, we've got the tree of life, and we know in the Garden of Eden, that's not the only tree there, that there's another tree that will have something to do with the fall, and if not exactly with death. But the tree imagery in mythic poems is often sort of playing on one side or the other, or seeing how the two are related. I mean, in this poem about a birthday, are the trees something like the tree of life, or are they something more menacing, do you think?
In looking back on the page before, I got at the end of the trees as a church, as a chapel.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the legends of the green chapels, which, I mean, this Thomas is always in tune with legends. I mean, I consider telling the legend he's thinking about there, which is Sir Gawain and the Green Knight, which you may know the story, which is a great tree myth itself about the Green Knight that shows up at Arthur's Round Table and says, "Who wants to chop me? And then I'll do it to you, and we'll see what happens." You know the story? That's sort of a great long story, but the short version is, is Percival who stands up? Anyway, the Green Knight says, okay, puts his head on a chopping block and gets his head chopped off, and then he bends down and picks up his head and walks off. And he is this tree man. And then in a year's time, the other knight is supposed to go do the same thing, which is fairly terrifying because he's not a tree man. And then the story goes on, and it's an exploration, really, of this principle of death and life and vegetable rebirth. And at the end, the knight sort of submits, but doesn't get his head chopped off. He just gets nicked. But I mean, he's thinking about trees in this poem in a lot of ways. He's got that myth, that story in mind. And he's got the word parable. I mean, it's not a very significant part of this poem, but it's was my sort of lead into this. But, I mean, this is Dylan Thomas in his seacoast Welsh town on his birthday. I mean, he's within 10 years of his death, although he doesn't know it at this time, thinking about what it means to be born, what it means to be alive, and sort of celebrating that. But with Dylan Thomas, if it's life, it's not only life. Yeah.
There's a lot of, I guess, cyclical. This is fall now.
Yes.
And the leaves are falling. And there's that other fall, too, which you mentioned earlier.
Yeah.
I don't think it's connected. But the cyclical idea of, you know, it's my birthday again. It will be next year. It was last year. And the trees have the cycle, and so do we.
Yeah. So nature has these cycles that people are connected to somehow. And those cycles are about birth. But anytime you have birth, death is in the wind. And when he's thinking about fall and blood, and there's even a sort of subtle reference to Christ.
The October red.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a painful thing. Here's the thing about it.
Yeah.
It's more painful.
The blood red trees, which makes us think of another tree which Christ was sacrificed on as a tree of life.
Certainly. The child who died, it's on the end. It's at the end.
Yeah. Anybody thinking about anything else that's not even necessarily related?
It brought up an image of walking through the town of Bodega, north of San Francisco, where Hitchcock's film The Birds was filmed.
Oh.
But the parable of sunlight I saw as sunbeams coming down through clouds, and when I try to draw it, it looks like trees.
Mm.
So there's, you know, in the absence of one green chapel, there are others if you just look for them.
So the parable of sun, yeah. That's something. Thomas loves to stick odd words next to each other. I mean that's kind of a, I mean, in some ways, when you get kids to start writing poetry, they just put weird stuff down, and they start doing that, and it looks kind of funny, but it looks like poetry because it doesn't look like not poetry. I mean, there's a sense of Dylan Thomas has a sort of that childlike aspect to his poetry, which after his death, some people said, oh, he's not that good. It was really just his celebrity that made people sort of interested in him. But it is good, I think. I mean, he is accomplishing something very interesting.
I was intrigued by that second stanza. My birthday began with the water birds, and the birds the leaf trees. Mm-hmm. And I'm going, yeah, why has wind affected trees instead of birds?
Yeah.
Flying away from the beginning, and I rose.
Yeah.
It's the start and then
the rain. There's a sense, I mean, he takes it, something, and then I'm not sure the technique even has a name, but then takes something associated with the earlier noun and attaches it to the subsequent one, and then sort of get this cycling effect going on in the poem.
I almost get the image of an out-of-body experience. He's above himself, above his life, looking
here. Yeah, floating above his town. I mean, and he is roaming around the hills looking at this town that he lives in. Yeah, well, let's try another one. This is the place I'd like to start in the Bible is where the tree of life first shows up. It's in Genesis. Again, it's a familiar story. Genesis 1 through 13 with a couple extras added. Someone want to read that? Anybody feel like getting on tape forever?
No. You want to begin at the very beginning?
Or? Yeah.
Okay. In the beginning, when God created the heavens and the earth was a formless void, and darkness covered the face of the deep, while a wind from God swept over the face of the waters. Then God said, "Let there be light," and there was light. And God saw that the light was good. God separated the light from the darkness. God called the light day, and the darkness God called night. and there was evening, and there was morning, the first day. And God said, let there be a dome in the midst of the waters, and let it separate the waters from the waters. So God made the dome, and separated the waters that were above the dome, that were under the dome, from the waters that were above the dome. And it was so. God called the dome sky. And there was evening, and there was morning, the second day. And God said, let the waters under the sky be gathered together into one place, and let the dry land appear. And it was so. God called the dry land earth, and the waters that were gathered together God called seas. And God saw that it was good. Then God said, let the earth put forth vegetation, plants yielding seed, and fruit trees of every kind on earth that bear fruit with the seed in it. And it was so. The earth brought forth vegetation, plants yielding seed of every kind, and trees of every kind bearing fruit with the seed in it. And God saw that it was good. And there was evening and there was morning, the third day.
Okay. So we've got trees being created, and then the tree of life actually gets plunked down in there. You want, what verse does that show up in? We should know.
It's
two, like, somewhere after four.
Chapter 3, verse 2-9.
Yeah, the
tree of life, yeah.
Okay, so we got to get the tree of life mentioned. Okay, so 2-9. Out of the ground the Lord God made to grow every tree that is pleasant to the sight and good for food, the tree of life also in the midst of the garden, and the tree of knowledge of good and evil. So there you get the trees. Okay, so in the beginning. It's interesting, I mean, trees are mythologized in many cultures in very similar ways, just something that always interests me. And I mean, the principle, which I find useful, I'll mention with a couple different poets, is referred to in a number of ways, but Eliade, the mythologist, uses a Latin term to talk about it as the coincidentia opitosorum. And that's sort of funny language, but I think it's useful. The coincidentia opitosorum, it means the coincidence of opposites. And myth tends, counter to logic, to constantly bring opposites together and show how they are the same. And so in mythic literature, you're constantly getting manifestations of how it can be that someone dying on a cross has something to do with life. And here in the Garden of Eden, at the very beginning of the Bible, we've got these trees. You've got the tree of life, and you've got this other tree. And opposites doesn't always only mean, and most of the time it doesn't mean good versus evil. In a moral framework, it's sort of more complex or subtle than that. But here certainly we have life and death. And here's Dylan Thomas. It's with a poem called, not surprisingly, you could guess, In the Beginning. I think I'll read this up here so I can
move it over just a little more.
Yeah,
on the way to center.
Can you see it? In the beginning was the three-pointed star, one smile of light across the empty face, one bow of bone across the rooting air, the substance forked that marrowed the first sun, and burning ciphers on the round of space, heaven and hell mixed as they spun. In the beginning was the pale signature, three-syllabled and starry as the smile. And after came the imprints on the water, stamp on the minted face upon the moon, the blood that touched the cross tree and the grail, touched the first cloud and left the sign. In the beginning was the mounting fire that set alight the weathers from a spark, a three-eyed, red-eyed spark, blunt as a flower. Life rose and sprouted from the rolling seas, burst in the roots, pumped from the earth and rock, the secret oils that drive the grass. In the beginning was the word that from the solid bases of the light abstracted all the letters of the void, and from the cloudy bases of the breath, the word flowed up, translating to the heart first characters of birth and death. In the beginning was the secret brain. The brain was celled and soldered in the thought before the pitch was forking to a sun, before the veins were shaking in their sieve, blood shot and scattered to the winds of light, the ribbed original of love.
Huh. What does it mean?
Yeah. I don't ask that question. I say, what do you see? Or pay attention to how you hear. What do you hear?
Your repetition is three.
Yeah.
It's envisioning golden in the triangle and seeing a trillion growing. And then three just jumped out at me here.
Yeah, I mean, the three-pointed star in here. I mean, if he's mentioning three with this kind of sensibility, he's got the Trinity in mind. I mean, a three-pointed star, I mean, what star would that be? Yeah, I mean, it's partly the star of Bethlehem, possibly.
Mercedes-Benz.
Could we just be referring to God?
Just God, just some divine sphere, yeah. In the beginning, I mean, this is language, I mean, in the beginning, what follows that in Genesis that we just read? In the beginning, God. So here we got in the beginning, it's not God, it's something else.
Star.
But there is some personification still going on.
It's also the word, three syllables in the beginning of the word.
Yes. And that's... Right, so it makes you think of John, and I mean, he even says that later in the fourth stanza. In the beginning was the Word. I mean, there we have just a quote from John. And that's a part of mythic poets, too. Blake does this. Dylan Thomas likes to think about, what does it mean to think about the power of the Word? In the beginning was the Word. I mean, there's a term for the type of power that if a word spoken can do something, which when God speaks, it's not like grow and it grows, it's like God speaks and it's there. That's referred to as a performative utterance. That is, a word that performs the act in its utterance. Lots of poets are fascinated by that, and poets that I tend to happen to like for some reason. So, I mean, that notion of a poet writing a poem, making something, I mean, you know, Dylan Thomas has got that in mind, that he's creating something as he's writing it, and it puts him in a God position. And I'm not sure he's very happy completely with being in that God position, because he's not God, but he is making stuff. And he's dealing with something with a power greater than himself, that is, the words which create the world we live in.
That's a powerful poem.
Is there any trees in it?
A cross tree.
That's the only reference, isn't it?
One mouth.
Yeah, you get growing stuff, grass.
Mouth.
Oh yeah, okay, good.
Third line.
And we've got this cross tree, which is interesting. Again, here's a poem about in the beginning. And the actual word tree that shows up is the cross.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot of blood. I mean, I've never thought of the in the beginning as it's, there's just all this kind of violent and kind of vigorous motion,
yeah.
And a lot of blood.
Yeah.
You know, so you don't, I don't think of that in the beginning as how much work it was. You think it's just kind of, you feel kind of the effort of it.
I mean, I think, not just because I tend to read Blake, but Thomas did too. William Blake was fascinated by all this sort of gory creation stuff too, and he drew pictures of it. I mean, he's got all kinds of versions of this myth. Some of them are very bizarre, but I mean, one version, I mean, a lot of them are sort of creation gone bad. You know, he's thinking about why things went so bad in certain respects. But he's got the spine. God, the God in Blake's poem sort of creates the spine, that's this human, and then sort of nails it down, and then the spine just starts thrashing around and sort of bashing the world apart. But as it's doing that, it starts sprouting these veins and ribs, and pretty soon the material world is created. I mean, the image from the end of this poem is very much sort of like that. He's got Eve being created from Adam's rib, sort of. I mean, that's, he's thinking about that.
I like the progression of the first line, the Eve verse too, and then you see you've got the now, and then you've got the action coming from that each.
Yeah.
Star, signature, fire, word, and brain.
Yeah. And a signature again. I mean, what signature is another word pointing to? Words, but a word that has something to do with identity. I mean, if your name is your identity, you're putting down your word, and it's also a sign. It's not the thing that it represents. So somehow exploring how these things we look at are what we think they are, but they're not. Yeah.
His first line has a reference to three. The second stanza, his second line has the reference to three. And the third stanza, the third line has the reference to three, and there are no references to three.
So then we get first.
Yeah.
So I see a progression of explanation. What does this mean? And then there's another verse. The last one seems, you know, that Christ was there before the world had life. Mm-hmm. We were already saved before we were created and fell.
Is that,
I mean, before? I mean, the brain is the explanation, the reason, or whatever.
So that the secret brain is God, God's brain.
God's thoughts on the matter. This was all created to demonstrate the saving grace.
And the cells, the cells in the brain, I mean, are the cells in the plants. Somehow they're that unity theme. Well, let's look at another one. How are we doing? This is another tree story in the Bible. You probably know, you probably don't read this one every day. But now I'm in Numbers 17. If you're sitting, I mean, it's a couple weeks ago and I was sitting down, okay, what tree references do I know in the Bible? This isn't one that came to mind. It only came to mind after I got out my concordance and started doing some rummaging. But you'll see. So we're Numbers 17, and I don't need to read too much, 1 through 11. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to the Israelites and get 12 staffs from them, one for each ancestral house, from all the leaders of their ancestral houses. Write each man's name on his staff, and write Aaron's name on the staff of Levi, for there shall be one staff for the head of each ancestral house. Place them in the tent of meeting before the covenant where I meet with you, and the staff of the man whom I choose shall sprout. Thus I will put a stop to the complaints of the Israelites that they continually make against you." Moses spoke to the Israelites, and all their leaders gave him staffs, one for each leader, according to their ancestral houses, 12 staffs. And the staff of Aaron was among theirs. So Moses placed the staffs before the Lord in the tent of the covenant. When Moses went into the tent of the covenant on the next day, the staff of Aaron for the house of Levi had sprouted. It put forth buds, produced blossoms, and bore ripe almonds. Then Moses brought out all the staffs from before the Lord to all the Israelites, and they looked, and each man took his staff. And the Lord said to Moses, put back the staff of Aaron before the covenant to be kept as a warning to rebels, so that you may make an end of their complaints against me, or else they will die. Moses did so just as the Lord commanded him. That's a great story, isn't it? I mean, that is the tree of life, isn't it? Or it's a manifest, symbolic manifestation of that. I mean, what's carried in that imagery? I mean, what comes to your mind when you just think of that story? Staff spread.
Stump of Jesse.
Explain.
Well, it's the young Isaiah that the Messiah will spring from the stump of Jesse, and it's a image of hope in the four people who've been crushed and whose lives have been sawn off at the base. But from that base will spring, grow, bring life.
Yeah.
To this people who've been cut down.
So that one leading all the way to Jesus, and Jesus on the tree, even.
The Levitical covenant.
And this is one of those sort of great tricks, too. I mean, this is fun to think about. You know, here's my staff, and now it grows. I mean, gardeners all know, anyway, you can go to a nursery and buy some dead-looking thing and poke it in the ground, and it does grow. I mean, that's one of the mysteries of life, that things that look dead grow. Here's a Dylan Thomas poem called A Grief Ago. If I can find it.
I don't know what I'm supposed to make of the fact that it was the Levites were the tribe of the priesthood, right? That's the only tree that grew.
Yeah.
What's that supposed to call me? Control.
Control. Levites are in charge of this. You shut up.
Now, I'm going to have to move it as I go. See that? Okay, so you can play the game. What's this doing next to the staff of Aaron? And you'll see. A grief ago, she who I hold, the fats and flower, or water lamb from the side-sided thorn, hell, wind, and sea, a stem cementing, wrestled up the tower, rose made and male, or masted Venus, through the paddler's bowl, sailed up the sun. I'd like to see him memorize this poem. I've never tried. Who is my grief? A chrysalis, unwrinkling on the iron, wrenched by my fingerman, the leaden bud shot through the leaf. Was who was folded on the rod of Aaron, rose cast to plague, the horn and ball of water on the frog housed in the side. And she who lies like Exodus, a chapter from the garden, brand of the lily's anger on her ring, tugged through the days, her ropes of heritage, the wars of pardon on field and sand, the 12 triangles of the cherub wind engraving going. Who then is she? She holding me? The people's sea drives on her, drives out the farther from the Caesared camp, the dens of shape all her whelps with the long voice of water, that she I have, the country-handed grave boxed into love, rise before dark. The night is near, a nitric shape that leaps her, time and acid. I tell her this, before the suncock cast her bone to fire, let her inhale her dead through seed and solid, draw in their seas, so cross her hand with their grave gypsy eyes and close her fist.
So you say.
Yeah.
Sure, he wasn't on a binge.
Well, it's that type of poem, you know, when he first was published, people said, wow, I like this. But, you know, it's like, I mean, that's also what people said about Blake was he wasn't a crafted writer. It was an automatic. In fact, they said he was on drugs, that you know, he'd take stuff and just write whatever would come to mind. I mean, that sounds like that, but it's full of patterns that constantly fill his other poems. But I mean, I wouldn't even want to ask, you know, what that poem means. I mean, I'm not even sure it's the best question often for poems. It's, I mean, he's playing with sounds as much as anything in that poem. And it's not just that, because, I mean, there are images and themes that are coming up, but certainly Thomas talked about this in his own poetry. I mean, when he wrote poems, what he liked to do was get a certain phrase that he just liked the sounds of. And sort of build the poem in both directions around something that he just liked.
I thought he was talking about sex, but that's not it. In the beginning, it's
You know, it's always about sex.
Under Milkwood it is, by the way.
I mean, one of his other sort of motivating interest was Freud, actually, which is, the poems I have aren't that Freudian, but you know, if it's Freudian, there's got to be sex in it. And
oh, there's sex in it.
Yeah. If that's about sex, then who's the master Venus?
Well, right after the master Venus, is that the first line? Because there's two. It's a. Yeah, he's contrasting and he's putting male and female images together.
Yes. And then again, that's part of his unity theme. What happens when you get a man and a woman together, married, whatever, biological fashion? When you put them together and somehow that undoes the fall, but it's never completely undoing the fall, and it's. I mean, in his own stormy relationships, I mean, it leads to as much grief as anything. And it is a poem about relationships somehow. I didn't put that up because I meant to explain it to you. But do you see that Aaron's rod shows up there? I mean, what's it doing there?
And the plague and the frogs.
Yeah. And Exodus. So
the whole chapter of Exodus.
I mean, it is. Moses is on his mind when he writes this.
Twelve triangles.
Right, you've got that 12 there for the tribe. I mean, if that numbers text we looked at is about, you know, who's the priests, who's going to be in charge of the priestly commissions here, it's something to do with that. Oh well. If you want to ponder it more, you can borrow my Dylan Thomas book. Read some more. I've got a couple more. We got, 7 minutes? So. I like this. It's in the same vicinity of the Old Testament. If you shift to Exodus, another version of the Tree of Life, which you probably would think of if I just asked you to think of, you know, trees. It's not exactly a tree, but then trees didn't get all that big in the biblical lands anyway, right? So I'm on Exodus 3. Which is about what?
Burning
bush, which is a great thing. I mean, to think about that as the tree of life, I mean, that this tree with fire, that God's there. If there are a longer period, I'd read the whole section. I mean, this is a great part of Exodus just to read. We'll just read a bit of it. So I'm Exodus 3:1. Moses was keeping the flock of his father-in-law Jethro, the priest of Midian. He led his flock beyond the wilderness and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. There the angel of the Lord appeared to him in a flame of fire out of a bush. He looked, and the bush was blazing, yet it was not consumed. Then Moses said, I must turn aside and look at this great sight and see why the bush is not burned up. When the Lord saw that he had turned aside to see, God called to him out of the bush, Moses, Moses. And he said, Here I am. Then he said, Come no closer. Remove the sandals from your feet, for the place on which you are standing is holy ground. He said further, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. And Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look at God. And you get this great dramatic scene. So, I mean, there's certainly an image for me of the tree of life. And I've got a Dylan Thomas poem called When All My Five and Country Senses. Somewhere. There. When all my five and country senses see, the fingers will forget green thumbs and mark how, through the half moon's vegetable eye, husk of young stars and handful zodiac, love in the frost is paired and wintered by. The whispering ears will watch love drummed away, down breeze and shell to a discordant breach, and lashed to syllables, the lynx tongue cry that her fond wounds are mended bitterly. My nostrils see her breath burn like a bush. My one and noble heart has witnesses in all love's countries that will grope awake. And when blind sleep drops on the spying senses, the heart is sensual, though five eyes break. Another one of those is not immediately obvious. That's why I started with this birthday poem. You sort of see that one. Anything going on in that poem? Or I should say, anything going on in your head? You think he had the burning bush in mind, or is that just an accident? My nostrils see her breath burn like a bush. You know, when it's poetry, it's never an accident. I mean, you probably, I mean, that's, he's thinking about coming across the presence of a woman, but as the divine.
It's almost as if the senses are not matched the way you think of them.
Right.
And that last line, the five eyes, I put the pronoun I as well. The five eyes.
Yeah, what I mentioned, you know, when a kid wants to write a poem, and say, well, let's have a nose, feel things, let's have eyes. You know, I mean that's what he's sort of doing in this poem, sort of shifting.
Seeing with the all his senses.
Yeah. I mean, this is, again, another Blakean poem. Blake talked about, if only the doors of perception were clean, we could see the infinite. Mm-hmm. And our five senses are such primitive. I mean, we have to open your mind and use something else if you want to experience the divine. I mean, that's why I think this poem is about Moses. I mean, Moses wasn't just an ordinary person. I mean, somehow he could use his imagination to see a bush and not just walk by, but say, I better go check this out. And is open to the presence of what happens when you encounter the tree of life. And this is a poem about, you know, opening your senses somehow.
What is a country sense? I mean, I grew up in the country, but I have no idea what a country sense is.
Yeah.
Works better than the city senses. Been dulled by pollution and stuff.
But I know what it is in Shakespeare. You know, Shakespeare talks about country matters. He's talking about sex. He's, the first syllable, which has been maintained in a slang word,
probably still fun.
Yeah. But that doesn't seem to be the pun there. I mean,
I don't know. I mean, that's a very strong and earthy sense of.
That's true. An earthy sense. And then we're back to Freud. So then we'll see. Well, I'm going to end with probably one of his most famous ones, and it can be on your way. And I think, oh, here it is. And in spite of what's going on this summer, this is not a Star Wars poem. The force that through the green fuse drives the flower. The force that through the green fuse drives the flower, drives my green age, that blasts the roots of trees, is my destroyer. And I am dumb to tell the crooked rose my youth is bent by the same wintry fever. The force that drives the water through the rocks drives my red blood, that dries the mouthing streams, turns mine to wax. And I am dumb to mouth unto my veins how at the mountain spring the same mouth sucks. The hand that whirls the water in the pool, stirs the quicksand, that ropes the blowing wind, hauls my shroud sail. And I am dumb to tell the hanging man how of my clay is made the hangman's line. The lips of time leech to the fountainhead. Love drips and gathers, but the fallen blood shall calm her sores. And I am dumb to tell a weather's wind how time has ticked a heaven round the stars. And I am dumb to tell the lover's tomb how at my sheet goes the same crooked worm. And I guess we'll let that speak for itself. And I thank you all for coming. It's been fun for me.